Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Through the Smoke on Firehouse Radio, radio at firehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder. Fire officers charged in firefighter deaths. Firefighters being injured and killed in the line of duty is not new, and while we're making progress, we still have a lot of work to do. In many cases, the deaths end in changes, but in so many, not much actually does change, and firefighters continue to get killed the same ways we always have. In March of 2005, a fire lieutenant and a rookie firefighter in Canada were killed in a small detached saw shed fire. And now, 1 year later, there are governmental charges, very serious charges that have been made against that city and their fire chief and their deputy fire chief and the deaths of those two firefighters. So we're going to be getting into that. And we've got some very special guests with us from Canada today who are going to be able to provide us some insight on not specifically the fire, but what happens in Canada versus what happens in the United States when there's a firefighter death. But first, let's take a look and see what's going on. We just got this in. Four volunteer firefighters on a fishing trip died today. Today, of course, is 3/16/06 for those of you that are downloading the show. And two swam to safety. Looks like they got in trouble. The four firefighters were out there on, looks like just a couple of good friends having a good time. Out on a boat and lost their lives. The firefighters who were killed were Kevin Bell, age 38, Griff Lungry, age 22, Mike Shope, 21, and Archie McFadden, 20, all from Banner Elk, North Carolina, which is in the North Carolina mountains. Their boat overturned out in the ocean for one reason or another, and it's too early to tell. But certainly our hearts and prayers go out to the families of Bell, Lungry, Shope, and McFadden, and all members of the North Carolina Fire Service, and specifically the Banner Elk firefighters. You'd have to be blind not to see what's going on in Oklahoma and Texas with the wildland fires out there. Our prayers are out to the firefighters that are trying to deal with that situation. You know, I was staring at a calendar today on the wall at our fire headquarters, and on it, it had a beautiful photograph of a FBI command unit. It looked like a big Federal Bureau of Investigation command unit. And I did some inquiries, and this thing cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they've bought dozens of them. And these things have gold leaf lettering and tons of red lights and sirens and all kinds of great stuff. And I don't know if the FBI needs those trucks or not. That's, you know, somebody a lot more important to me to figure out. But then I watched the news at the same time. I gander from this calendar of this, you know, $600,000-$800,000 what looks like a heavy duty rescue truck command unit that the FBI has with gold leaf lettering on it. And I glance from one corner of our office at our fire headquarters to another, and there's the TV with firefighters in Texas and Oklahoma running around in 1970s vintage brush trucks. I don't know. I don't know what more I'm going to say about that, other than it was certainly a striking contrast to me about how sometimes the federal funds are being spent. But that's for another show, maybe. Sadly, Destry Horton, a firefighter critically injured battling the wildfires in Oklahoma, is fighting to stay alive, his mother said last week. The hospital says they've never had anybody this badly burned who survived this long, Jerry Thomas's mom said. Thomas said her son's arms were amputated this week, and he could also lose his foot. His condition is listed as critical at Indegree Baptist Medical Center burn unit. Horton, a firefighter age 32, suffered burns to about 50% of his body when he was trapped by a wildland fire March 1st near Duncan, Oklahoma. He's a firefighter at Chickasha and gave up his day. He took a day off to battle the blaze to help fight those fires. Horton and a Rush Springs firefighter entered a smoke-filled area and their apparatus got stuck. Horton is married with two young daughters, and quoting his mom, she says he's with God now, but he doesn't want to let go of his family. He wants to live, and we're praying he will. He is aware of his surroundings, and he can hear and see. Every time he wiggles his legs, it's because he hears someone say, "I'm here, and I'm praying for you." So our hearts and prayers go out to firefighter Destry Horton in Oklahoma, who is battling an incredible battle to stay alive after fighting these wildland fires that are going on down there. We also found that a New Jersey firefighter died this week after a 15-year coma. Camden, New Jersey, which is a very, very hard working fire department, lots of activity in Camden. Firefighter George Jackson was 67 years old. He was on the job 24 years with Camden before he was severely injured on October 21st, 1990. The injuries occurred when firefighter Jackson and two other firefighters encountered basically looks like a flashover while conducting a primary search of a residential fire. After remaining in a coma for 15 years, firefighter Jackson passed away just a few weeks ago, March 7th, as a result of his injury. So our hearts and prayers, of course, go out to those in Camden, New Jersey, and the families of firefighter or family members of firefighter George Jackson. And not too far from Camden, we're watching Prince George's County, Maryland, and it looks like now the firefighters who are fighting each other over in Prince George's County, looks like the fire chief is asking, and the public safety director is asking the state to press charges, criminal charges, against volunteer firefighters who were involved in the battle down there. And we weren't there, much like much of what we talk about, we're not there. So all we can do is go by the accounts we read about, and we don't always believe what we read in the press. But something happened, and somebody was pissed off at somebody, and somebody didn't like somebody running somebody's hose over, and somebody didn't like having somebody else's hose line in the building first, and all that other crap, which really doesn't matter. It's obviously a bunch of people have forgotten what the mission's for, and it's going to take some leader down there. I don't know about charges and putting people in jail and all that stuff. I don't know if that's going to work or not. But somebody needs to sound a big wake-up call and remind people why they belong to the fire department. It's real simple. When Mrs. Jones or Mrs. Smith calls 911, we get there safely, effectively, with enough people and some good leaders to put the fire out, solve their problems. This kind of fighting, you know, happened in the 1700s and the 1800s, and here we are in the year 2006, and we're still acting like a bunch of dinosaurs and a bunch of clowns. Somebody's got to get a handle on it, because as much as they think it's their problem, with this kind of publicity, it reflects negatively on all firefighters all over the place. Another incident we covered a few weeks ago is in Michigan, Ann Arbor firefighter Amy Pennywit was operating on the highway at an auto accident when she was struck. Stephen Zickoff, who's 48 years old of Ann Arbor, Michigan, was eastbound on I-94 near Jackson Road the morning of January 7th when his vehicle slid on ice, struck the median wall, hit another vehicle, and then struck Ann Arbor firefighter Amy Pennywit from behind, and she was killed. She just arrived there 3 minutes earlier. She died 6 days later at the U of M Medical Center. They decided to not pursue criminal charges, stating it was just a sad set of circumstances, and this would have happened to anybody operating on the highway. You know, whether or not they charge somebody or not, we still have to remember how dangerous it is on the highways, and we've done some shows on that, and we'll be doing some more in the future. But just keep in mind, gang, when you're operating on the highway, protect your personnel with big-ass fire apparatus. Put the tower ladder across the road. Put the rescue truck across the road. Protect your personnel. We've also done a couple columns and close calls in Firehouse Magazine and all sorts of other stuff. I don't know how many more wake-up calls we're going to need before we realize the safest way for us to operate is protect ourselves on the highway by either shutting down traffic, diverting it in a coordination with the police department, fully diverting it, and then blocking any access to our people with big fire engines. Otherwise, we're going to continue to get struck. We've got to use caution. I mean, too many of us are getting killed on a regular basis. You know, and for every one of us killed, there's 4 police officers killed. 1 for every 4. Cops take it a lot harder out on the highway because they're doing traffic stops and things like that. And nothing we want to, you know, we're not involved in, so their frequency is even higher. The International Association of Chiefs of Police just put out a program sent to every police department in the nation saying the name of the program is Your Vest Won't Stop This Bullet. And it's about the hazards to police officers operating on roadways and highways. Why is that important to you? Because a lot of times you deal with cops who tell you, you know, too bad, we're going to keep this road open and stuff like that. Well, if the International Association of Chiefs of Police thinks it's a problem, well, now maybe it's a problem. So check that out, and maybe if your cops don't have that, send me an email. I'll tell you where you can get a copy of that video and show it to them, and maybe you guys can get together and figure out what now why we need to protect and block the highways. And lastly, a driver has been found guilty in an accident that killed a Kansas City firefighter. Jurors convicted a Kansas City woman this week of causing a traffic accident that killed a veteran firefighter. LaDonna Davis, 38, could receive probation and up to 4 years in prison for second-degree involuntary manslaughter. A judge is going to sentence her later. The victim, firefighter Gerald McGowan, who was a Kansas City firefighter for 32 years, he had 32 years on the job, was getting ready to retire a few months after the accident. Before the trial began this week, Davis pleaded guilty to driving with a revoked license at the time of the September 5th accident. She faces up to a year in jail for that separately. Pumper number 33, with lights flashing and sirens and air horn blaring, hit her car from behind as she turned left into the lane the pumper was using to pass her. Loaded with 1,000 gallons of water and four firefighters, the truck clipped her small sedan and spun around. The pumper then struck the car of a man who had pulled over, severely injuring him, before jumping the curb. And as it careened, a wooden telephone pole smashed into the tree. They swerved a wooden telephone pole and smashed into a tree. Three firefighters survived their injuries, but it left Kansas City firefighter Gerald McGowan dead. Again, tragedy on the roadways. Everywhere we look, every time, you know, you open up firehouse.com or read the magazines, one of us has been struck or one of us is involved in an apparatus accident. We got to slow down. We got to stop at red lights. We've got to stop at traffic control devices such as stop signs. And you know what? Drive defensively. I don't know how many more of these crashes we're going to have before we start to get it. We'll be back in a minute. We're going to start talking about some serious stuff. Fire chief and deputy chief in Yellowknife, Canada, charged in the death of their firefighters. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Firefighter deaths trigger charges in Canada. Safety charges have been laid against the city of Yellowknife, Canada, and its top of fire officials in the deaths of a firefighter from Calgary and his comrade in a blaze last year. The charges include failing to take reasonable precautions to ensure the health and safety of their crews, as well as failing to properly instruct each firefighter in the safe performance of his or her duties. Kevin Olson, 24 years old, had been on the job just 10 days when he was killed by a collapsing roof while fighting a fire at a hardware store in March 2005. I should mention the actual store wasn't on fire. It was a saw shed on the side of the building that they were dealing with. The rookie firefighter from Calgary, who is now working up in Yellowknife, got married 6 weeks before his death. 6 weeks before he was married, and then he died. The couple was planning to fly to Russia to meet his wife's family. Cyril Fife, who was a lieutenant with Yellowknife, 18 years on the job, was also injured in the blaze, and he died later in the hospital when the family took him off life support. He left a wife and five kids behind. The Northwest Territories Workers' Comp Board laid the charges out, and the quote is that the charges were necessary in order to fulfill our responsibility to enforce and the Safety Act and regulations. Fire Chief Mike Beauchamp and Deputy Fire Chief Darcy Hernblad face a hefty penalty if found guilty. It could be up to $500,000 or imprisonment for a term not exceeding a year or both. Absolutely unbelievable. I'm not saying we agree or disagree. We're going to talk about this for a little while. But in the United States, that's unheard of, and that's sort of where we're going with this discussion. Olson and Fife were inside the burning building when the roof caved in on them. There were firefighters operating on that roof, which was also covered with ice and snow, trying to make a hole to get to the fire, which spread through the trusses. The crew on the roof, who fell through the hole, managed to escape without any serious injuries. So let's dig a little bit deeper into these actual charges. And I've got the paperwork here in front of me from the Workers' Comp Board of Northwest Territories in Canada, and I'll just read you their press release. They've laid charges under the Northwest Territories Safety Act in connection with the fire March 17th that caused the deaths of the two firefighters that I just mentioned. The charges are against the city of Yellowknife, two charges were laid against Yellowknife Fire Chief, and two charges laid against the Deputy Fire Chief in Yellowknife as well. And the charges are as follows. The City of Yellowknife is being charged with failure to take all reasonable precautions and adopt and carry out all reasonable techniques and procedures to ensure the health and safety of every person in its establishment within the Yellowknife Fire Department, which basically I'm reading to see, and this says to me, you are responsible to take all reasonable precautions to make sure your personnel are safe. And part two of this, to the fire chief, they're charging him with failure to take all reasonable precautions and adopt and carry out all reasonable techniques and procedures to ensure the health and safety of his personnel directly at the Yellowknife Fire Department. And they're charging him with failure to ensure the adequate instruction of each worker in the safe performance of his or her duties. In other words, the failure to ensure your firefighters are properly trained, and the deputy fire chief, the same charges. Each of these folks, I've got to be going through hell. I'm not even going to talk about the families who lost their loved ones. But there, but for the grace of God, go us, is what I was thinking when I read this. You know, 2 years ago this week, two Pittsburgh firefighters were tragically killed in a collapse while operating in the final stages of a church fire. Battalion Chief Charles Brace, age 55, was acting as one of the incident safety officers, and Master Firefighter Richard Stephanakis, 51. They were both inside performing overhaul, extinguishing remaining hotspots. This is several hours after the initial alarm, inside the church vestibule when the bell tower collapsed on top of them, killing them and injuring 20-plus firefighters. A backdraft occurred earlier in the incident that injured additional six firefighters. The call came in at 8:45, the backdraft occurred at 9:28, and the collapse of that church bell tower occurred at 12:14. Do the math. This first is, of course, to remember, the first thing we need to do here is to remember the loss and suffering that the members of the Pittsburgh Fire Department have gone through, or I think they call it the Pittsburgh Bureau of Fire up there. Even more importantly, it's to remember the Brace and Stephanakis family members who lost their heroes. These are their loved ones. These are the daddies who aren't coming home again, the husbands, the brothers. Their lives, like all line-of-duty death survivors, will never be the same. Think about the families, gang. The second, remember, is that when firefighters are killed, every one of us has a high-priority responsibility to study that fire, learn from it, and do whatever we can to make sure it's not repeated. That's got to occur from the smallest rural firehouse to the biggest city firehouse, and it's got to affect every firefighter no matter what. And when you're done learning, we have to make sure you run calls, and those folks who run with you run calls learn too. In other words, it's a team effort to learn what happened so it doesn't happen here. Whose job is it to get done? You. Spread the facts. Not some of this nonsense that goes on some of the chat rooms, bulletin boards, and forums, but by all of us getting the facts from the reports and the Pittsburgh Fire, there's a NIOSH report out on that. You go to their website, you can download it. You learn from these affected fire departments and from the reports, and you take these reports and you put it in the faces of those who go with you to fires. Include it in your drills, your trainings, emails, whatever it takes. Put it in the bathrooms, post it above the urinals, I don't care what you do, but share the information so a little bit of the thought process goes out and all of us start thinking about what happened there so it doesn't happen here. Keeping this stuff in their face works. We just have to want to do it. And you know, we did it again just a few weeks ago when Moulton, Alabama Fire Captain Lloyd McCulloch, 63 years old, and Firefighter Dusty Jones, who was 23, were hitting hot spots at a fire that had been burning for hours. And then a concrete wall predictably collapsed, killing them instantly. The firefighters were pronounced dead at the scene, but what were they killed for? And as you might have seen on that news clip, the obviously friendly and wonderful Captain McCulloch, who was also their chaplain, had talked about the dangers of firefighting. I mean, they interviewed him at this fire. He was talking about the dangers of firefighting, remarking how lucky they were that no one had been hurt at that job, and he was thankful to all the mutual aid companies, and then he and Firefighter Jones were killed by that unstable wall just moments later. Did you see the picture of Captain McCulloch with his granddaughter, the one that was on some of the websites? What a gorgeous little girl with her happy granddad. That's now history. And then, to the north, as I was talking before, Yellowknife, Canada. Two more tragic deaths occurred on March 17th, a year ago this week, when those two firefighters were killed operating at a detached saw shed, a saw shed used to saw lumber at a home supply business. What's the value? It was a simple shed with sawdust in it. So what did those two firefighters in Yellowknife die for? And now this week, there are actually governmental charges, as we were talking about before, against the city of Yellowknife and their chief. And we're going to dig into this in just a few minutes. The chiefs, and as I said earlier, there, but for the grace of God go us, face those heavy penalties if found guilty. It's unbelievable. The fire chief and the deputy fire chief being charged. Wow. It's different in parts of Canada. The chiefs, the incident commanders, etc., can be charged. I don't know, would we operate any different in the United States knowing that we can be charged? And we're going to talk about that as we move forward in the show this afternoon. We need to do our best to protect property. There's no question about it. That's our mission. But the priority of life and property are two very, very different levels. Some firefighters that you know and I know will kick and scream saying, it's our job to protect property. Yeah, it is. But the two are very, very different. Some firefighters feel, hell, if we die doing that, that's just a risk of the job. You need to take your head out of your ass if that's your attitude. So who is it that wants us to die, or to die for what? I'm not saying, and we're not saying, we shouldn't go in. I want to go in as much as anybody. I'm saying that when the building is unoccupied, we should not get killed. The risk-benefit of an occupied building is not worth you getting killed. At this point in your career, you have figured out, I hope, that the building owner could give two shits about you, right? And yes, every once in a while, we as firefighters must give up our lives to save another life. That's part of the job. But those occasions are very rare. You know it and I know it. Just look at our line of duty death stats. How many of us died saving or trying to save a person? Very, very few. But giving up our lives to save a building, especially buildings that have been burning, and of course burning means unstable, or are very, or clearly unstable, or buildings that have a little worth, we got to think. What's the value of our life versus that building that's on fire? Most firefighter deaths are totally avoidable. The IAFC's executive director, Gary Breeze, calls many of firefighter deaths that we read about fratricide, F-R-A-T-R-I-C-I-D-E. Google that word. Do you still feel strongly that we have to give up our lives to save somebody's building? Still think that's part of the job? Come up to Emmitsburg this fall for the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation Memorial Weekend, where you can firsthand meet the wives, kids, husbands, siblings, friends, parents, the firefighter of those firefighters killed in line of duty. Grab a free cup of coffee and have a lively chat with one of them. Tell them how you feel about the risks that we must take, and they'll spend a few minutes explaining to you why you need to see things a lot more clear. So then, if your families don't want you to die, and your fire department doesn't want you to die, and the building owners and occupants don't care about you, then who is it that we're getting killed for? Who then is it that wants you to die? For who and for what? And another tragic loss this week, happening 5 years ago, March 14, 2001, when firefighter Brett Tarver died at the Southwest Supermarket fire in Phoenix, Arizona. Firefighter Tarver died from carbon monoxide poisoning and thermal burns after running out of air and becoming disoriented. The Phoenix Fire Department has shared everything they learned about the incident with anybody that would listen, with the hope that we can all learn from that tragic loss. In addition to Pittsburgh, Yellowknife, and Phoenix anniversaries this week, we're also reminded of the Chesapeake, Virginia firefighters, Frank Young and John Hutchkins, who were horribly killed on March 18, 1996. They were killed while operating an auto parts store fire, which on arrival initially appeared to be a minor situation, when later, as the fire advanced, the roof collapsed on them. Take some time this week to remember the families, friends, and fellow firefighters and officers of Phoenix's Brett Tarver, Pittsburgh's Charlie Brace and Richard Stefanakis, and Chesapeake's Frank Young and John Hutchins, and of course Yellowknife Canada Fire Lieutenant Cyril Fife and firefighter Kevin Olson. So now, let's take a few minutes and we're going to go for a deeper look into Yellowknife Canada. I've got with us today on the show retired Division Chief Aaron Feldman, who's retired from the Vancouver Fire Department, who is a member of the Canadian Fallen Firefighters Foundation. He works for them, but he's speaking basically as a retired fire chief today and not specifically representing the Fallen Firefighters Foundation, as well as retired Chief Gordon Routley, formerly of Shreveport, Louisiana, Phoenix, Arizona, well-known in the safety circles here in the United States, active with the ISC Safety, Health, and Survival Section, plays a leadership role with the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, and currently is the technical advisor to the Fire Chief of Montreal, Canada. Welcome, Aaron.
Great to be here. Great to be here, Billy. Thanks for having me on the show.
Appreciate your time. And Gordon, thanks for your time today as well.
I'm glad to be here, Billy.
Well, in the United States, clearly fire chiefs suffer when something goes wrong, whether it's emotional suffering or on the rare occasion where they're sued or charges are brought against them, or perhaps the union, either justifiably or unjustifiably, depending upon the situation, takes a vote of lack of confidence on them. But in Canada, it's different. And really, only in the last couple of years have I learned that in Canada, it's pretty serious. Basically, let's start with you, Aaron. Can you explain, just sort of outline for our listeners, what happens when a firefighter is killed? And does this apply to serious injuries, too? But what happens in Canada, or is it by each province, which is a state? What happens?
It does vary by jurisdiction, but typically throughout the Canadian workforce, we'll just cover that off for just a second, the roles of the supervisors are taken very, very seriously. And that's fairly recent as well, in that Bill C-45 came into effect in March of 2004.
So this is fairly new to you guys.
Yeah, to this level it is.
And is C-35, is that countrywide?
Yeah, Bill C-45 is a federal act amending the criminal code, and it's directly related to supervisors in the workforce. And, of course, in my position with Vancouver just prior to retirement, when this came in, my areas of jurisdiction were occupational health and safety, and this was something we had to deal with very effectively to all our supervisors. And now we can talk fire, and we'll say our lieutenants, captains, district chiefs, battalion chiefs, right on up to the fire chief himself, had to be aware of what their roles and responsibilities were relative to the safety of our members throughout the organization, and who would be, could be held liable in under the criminal code in negligence causing death.
Now, let me just jump for a second. I'm going to kind of jump between the U.S. and Canada. So, first of all, your supervisor is anyone who oversees firefighters. Could be a lieutenant, all the way up to the chief of department, correct?
Let me just quote you real quick.
Everyone who
undertakes or has the authority to direct how another person does work or performs a task is under a legal duty to take reasonable steps to prevent bodily harm to that person or any other persons arising from that work or task.
So in most fire departments, our policies and procedures, if they're not woefully out of date, state that you, lieutenant, captain, chief, deputy, assistant, whatever you might be, are responsible to take care of your people. But it's not really federal law here in the United States, or if it is, nobody's doing much about it. But in Canada, in 2004, they said, let's make this real clear to you. If a firefighter gets, now is this hurt or killed or both?
A person can be convicted of criminal negligence causing death.
Okay, so if
so
a
this
firefighter,
is for line of duty death,
okay,
which
so
is punishable by up to life imprisonment or criminal negligence causing bodily harm, okay, injury, which is punishable by up to 10 years imprisonment. So
okay,
it covers both.
Unbelievable.
It covers both.
It's borderline murder.
Well,
I mean,
they've amended the criminal code to say, and again, found negligent, meaning you, through the course of your not being aware of something, you chose to send this person in, and I mean, I don't want to interpret the law, I'm not a lawyer, and I wouldn't begin to do that,
sure.
But you can appreciate where this is coming from. It's really putting the onus on the supervisor, on the captain, on the lieutenant, to know what his people are capable of, work within those capabilities, and any standards and education provided within your organization. Step out of that realm. For whatever reason you cannot justify, you could be in big trouble.
That's pretty incredible. And again, I'm not saying it's good or bad yet. I'm saying that it certainly is a heavy motivator for a fire officer to do their jobs for those that don't necessarily do their jobs right.
Well, that's what we tried to do in Vancouver when we got this out. We had a training program in place where we put this through, and we covered every fire station, every shift, tried to capture every member before I left to ensure they were aware of the new law for obvious reasons you just stated.
So I'm getting on my apparatus, and we pull out on a run, and our department has a safety policy where you've got to wear seatbelts, no ifs, ands, or buts. Our apparatus has a collision. One of my people is killed by ejection. I could be charged under this law.
The likelihood is that you would be, simply because you did not ensure that that belt was buckled on all your personnel before leaving the fire station.
I didn't supervise. In other words, I took the test. I couldn't wait to get promoted. I got my lieutenant's bars. I went home when nobody was looking. I put my uniform on and stood in the mirror for about 2 hours. I said, wow, I look great. I got to the firehouse the next day, and I failed to supervise, and I can be charged.
Yes, sir.
Okay. We're going to come back in a minute. I just have to be respectful of the time. We'll be back in a minute. We're going to dig even further in this, but wow, pretty incredible. We're going to come back and chat with Gordon Routley a little bit and get some perspective from Gordon, who's done a lot of work both in the United States and Canada. We'll be right back.
Welcome to the latest edition of Through the Smoke with Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, addressing issues impacting all firefighters' safety, health, and morale.
This is Through the Smoke. I'm Billy Goldfeder. We're on radio at firehouse.com. We're having a pretty intense discussion about what happens in Canada based upon federal law when a member of the workforce is killed or injured. And I should mention that these charges against any fire personnel are not exclusive to fire. If a police supervisor doesn't properly supervise, if a factory supervisor doesn't properly supervise, it applies to everybody. So they're not picking on fire departments and fire chiefs, but this applies to the entire workforce. Aaron, a couple questions I have, and then we're going to get to Gordon. I want to get some perspective from you, Gordon, because you've been in the trenches in the U.S. and Canada, and I think can offer us some thoughts there. First of all, a quick question, Aaron. Is this done by jury? Who makes these decisions?
Well, if a charge came under Bill C-45, it would be under the criminal code and would have to be laid by the Crown Prosecutor as a criminal charge, in which case then you would get legal counsel and it could go to trial by judge or trial by jury.
Okay, so it could be trial by judge or jury. And what step, and again, I know you guys, out of respect to the legal process, don't want to comment specifically to Yellowknife, but let me ask you a technical question. Where does this stand at Yellowknife? Is this at just the first stage where the charge has been laid?
Well, what we have to do is really wait, and I don't mean to be evasive.
No, I understand.
I'll just quote the latest update I got yesterday, actually. I was flying out and checked my email just before I left.
Sure.
And Tanya Fraser was the spokesperson who did the press release, was right. Quoted as Fraser later corrected the WCB press release, saying that charges have been filed in court, although no one has been formally charged yet. They may have been by now. This is 1 day old that I'm telling you. But again, if charged, they will go through the court process and likely have to come under the criminal code if it's that kind of charge they're talking about. And don't forget that I'm sure you read, they had a number of orders issued by WCB in Yellowknife in advance of the release of this press release that they sent out.
Why don't you share, before I go to more questions, share with our listeners what were those orders were. Are you prepared to do that?
Yeah.
Just generally.
Things that came out.
Let's just remember, the Yellowknife firefighters, the Yellowknife chiefs, these are our brothers and sisters up there. We're not playing judge or jury today. What we're doing is presenting primarily the American Fire Service. I know we've got tons of listeners in Canada, but they're familiar with this. But also we've got, we're averaging about 10,000 to 12,000 listeners when we do this show. So we've got folks outside the USA as well in other countries. But primarily we're focusing here for the interest of firefighters in the United States of America, as what's happening just north of us. Go ahead, Aaron.
The reason I thought it was good to share some of the orders that were issued by the board is because, just forget about Yellowknife for a minute, and just as you listen to these, think of your own department and see, holy cow, maybe we need to be looking at some of this. And some examples are, one, create a full-time safety officer position in the fire department, train to national standards. Develop and implement a comprehensive fire department health and safety program. Where were we just having a mini-summit on what? Health and safety.
Right.
Just last month, okay? Conduct an external audit of fire department operational procedures and guidelines to identify deficiencies and suggest corrective actions. Evaluate current training practices. Develop a procedure for all personnel responding to call for firefighting duty. It goes on. There's a few others, but I think those were some key ones in light of, you know, the initiatives.
These were orders
issued by the board to that fire department.
Saying, so, you are to do this. And
yes.
This is after the line of duty deaths, correct?
That's correct. And
so
prior
the
to the release of...
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So the chief's office gets these orders. I mean, they've dealt with the tragic death, both publicly and emotionally and personally. And I mean, Yellowknife is not... Yellowknife is very isolated, so I'm sure almost everybody in Yellowknife knows everybody in Yellowknife.
Yes.
So there's enough of that stress, the horror stress of dealing with two firefighters killed. Now the Workers' Comp Board is saying, you must do these things, and they got that. And then a few weeks later, they're notified that they're going to be formally charged.
I was just speaking to a wife of, well, Cyril's wife, just a little while ago. Kevin's parents just a little while before that, as we stay in touch and so on, preparing for our national ceremony coming up this September in Ottawa. And I met Darcy at Kevin's funeral, which we had in Calgary last year. And I
who's Darcy?
The deputy chief, sorry.
Okay, all right, okay.
Yeah.
All right,
and,
I want to make
and,
it clear.
I get in my email what's happening in the press release, and, you know, to what you said earlier, I just, I feel for them. We all hurt for them to know what is going on. We don't know, to think of what might be going on up there,
right,
in their hearts, in with their families, of the survivors as well as the firefighters themselves, you know, their leadership is a question. Is it in question? What's going on? I couldn't even imagine what they're going through.
But we still have to remember...
Yes.
Two firefighters were killed.
Absolutely.
And
I just don't want to take away from the fact that, you know, we are really concerned and wanting to do whatever we can for these two chiefs who are having the difficulties right now they're having to deal with.
Absolutely. But, you know, that's the old, you know, it's lonely at the top and all those other sayings. And believe me, I know, you know, firsthand, it's more than challenging to be a chief these days, whether you be at a battalion, deputy, or whatever. Lieutenant, same thing. It's not... all fun and games, but some of us act, it's all fun and games until somebody loses an eye. It's all fun and games until something bad happens. It's all fun and games until something tragic happens. And now, you know, and in this show many, many times over time, we've discussed how out of nowhere this type of tragedy can occur, firefighter deaths. But if you look deep into it, it's not out of nowhere. The warning signs were there, whether it be in this department or any department. They knew this would happen at some point. Operations, where maybe training wasn't kept upright, whatever it is. So a lot of times when you'll hear someone say, this happened out of nowhere, if you take a look, take a minute and look, it really didn't. All the warning signs are there. If you don't do training, it's going to happen. If you don't have certification process, it's going to happen. If you don't have officers that got some gonads and are willing to enforce the policies, it's going to happen. Gordon Routley. Gordon served with the Phoenix Fire Department, leaving as Chief Brunicini's right-hand man, basically, right? Was that your title, Gordon, assistant to the fire chief?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and you moved on to be fire chief in Shreveport, Louisiana, and now you are the technical advisor to the fire chief in Montreal, Canada. You've worked in areas such as Prince George's County, Maryland. You served as a safety officer there, and really you've been involved in American and Canadian firefighter safety and death prevention for years. So I welcome you, Gordon. How about some comments? What do you think? What are you hearing?
Well, I think the most important thing is to compare the way the regulatory authorities in the U.S. and in Canada deal with worker health and safety, and specifically firefighter health and safety. First, the expectations that are placed on employers and on organizations in Canada are similar to what's required in the States, but the application is much more strict.
Gordon, let me just make a comment, and again, we have a full range of listeners, but for those that are listening, Canada is a democracy, just like the United States. I mean, people vote and have freedoms and things like that, but there are some differences, and I think that's what you're touching on now, Gordon.
Yeah, there's some structural differences. You know, first with the federal system in the U.S., for instance, there are the federal OSHA regulations, which apply to workers across the country, except they don't apply in about half of the states to firefighters because they're employees of local government. As local government employees, they come under state regulation rather than federal regulation. So if the you know, if the state isn't enforcing the federal regulations don't apply to firefighters. And
Gordon, you hear that? You know, people say, "Well, we're not an OSHA state, so we can drive drunk and you know, ride the tailboard sideways and all that kind of crazy crap." But when somebody says they're not an OSHA state, to be an OSHA state, the state decides whether they want to be one or not.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a decision that each state decides whether they're going to adopt their own health and safety regulations or use the federal regulations.
Okay.
And each state also decides what's going to apply to public employees within that state. So a particular state might say we're going to apply everything to local government employees, to firefighters, that applies under the federal regulations, or a particular state might decide to exempt firefighters entirely.
And about half the states are have adopted OSHA and half have not? Is that
right around 25 okay. You know, that use the federal regulations. And some states have more strict regulations, and some states just go with the basic federal.
So the first difference we're seeing here is that Canada adopted a federal law and said, we don't care who you are, what you are, this law is going to apply. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, the criminal law came after all of the provinces and territories had adopted their own legislation, which is, you know, at least as strict as the OSHA regulations in the U.S. and in most cases more strict. So every jurisdiction in Canada had already adopted those regulations and applied them to firefighters without exemptions.
And then the federal level in Canada came along with almost this umbrella policy, if you will.
Really, yeah. What they did is they changed the criminal code to say that...
The federal criminal code.
Yeah, the criminal code is a federal piece of legislation.
Okay.
So they came along and said that failure to follow the health and safety regulations that results in bodily injury or results in a fatality is a criminal offense. So, you know, you can get substantial fines or go to jail for failure to follow the occupational safety and health regulations if it results in a death or injury.
So there's several layers there that really, really can apply.
Yeah. So, for instance, in the case of Yellowknife, they can take action under the Northwest Territories Occupational Safety and Health Laws, or if the Crown Prosecutor decides that it's warranted, they can take criminal action.
What's a Crown Prosecutor? Is that the federal prosecutor?
The Crown Prosecutor is local, but it's the equivalent of the district attorney.
Okay, so it's your local province law enforcement agency, attorney's office. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they have to judge legally whether it merits criminal charges or would be handled by administrative charges by the Occupational Safety and Health Authority in that province or territory.
Okay.
So they're very strict in that regard and don't separate firefighters really from other workers, which is, you know, fairly common in the U.S. There's an attitude that firefighting is dangerous and you have to make a lot of allowances because of the nature of the mission, whereas in Canada, pretty much the Occupational Safety and Health Authority say, you know, the fire departments are expected to be just as safe as everybody else.
Let me ask you guys both a question. You can answer it together, but that would probably sound stupid, so why don't you both answer it separately. If the firefighters here or anywhere in Canada were running into a building on that rare occasion where mom is standing on the front porch and she's screaming, my babies are inside, so two or three firefighters dart in there attempting to make a grab, and for one reason or another, there's a flashover, there's a collapse, and they get killed, are the charges going to be, do you think they would consider the same charges, or do they consider at the risk you're taking, the risk versus benefit, does that play in any past cases you're aware of? I'll start with Aaron.
What would actually be looked at, from my understanding, is was everything in place? Was incident command in place? Was a safety officer in place? Was a proper assessment of the situation done to warrant the risk versus benefit, whereby you did a risk assessment, it was worth the risk, you went in, shit happened, they wouldn't dare lay a charge under those circumstances. But God forbid that you did a poor assessment and there was no way
right.
that you knew that building, your response
right.
time was delayed or whatever.
Yeah, it was half falling down when you got there.
That could
right.
be a problem.
Right.
Okay,
Gordon?
So, was that clear?
From your standpoint, Gordon,
yeah.
comments?
Yeah, I think that's what would happen. They would probably refer to NFPA 1500. They would look to the two-in and two-out regulation.
So they'd look at accepted standards.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Constantly refer to NFPA standards in particular and say, was the situation reasonable? If it came back and said that this fire department had been working on the edge of reality for a long time, then they might lay charges based on what they had failed to do over 100 circumstances in the past.
So they go back?
Yeah. They'll go back and they'll say, how do you work normally?
Okay.
If there's a fatality which triggers an investigation, they'll go back and say, well, in this case, maybe it was reasonable to violate two in and two out because there was a chance of performing a rescue. But they look at it and say, but do you do this normally? And and they can charge you with violating the two in and two out rule for all the other cases when it wasn't a life and death situation.
Billy, understand the investigators will go back. And they will look at your training practices. They will look at your training records. They will look at your past accident investigations. And if there's anything untoward, they're going to find it. So when it comes to documenting training, having proper training, all of this comes into effect when the investigator gets a hold of stuff.
So the difference here is in the United States when NIOSH investigates and this is geared, I guess, toward Gordon, when NIOSH, who does investigate every firefighter fatality, goes in, they do similar activities. They take similar actions in the investigation, but they merely issue a report because they're not a law enforcement agency. Is that a correct assessment?
That's right. They're fact-finding, so they,
right.
they identify...
And who, by the way, in my opinion, do a great job. I mean, I think NIOSH is kicking it up a notch here lately and really... becoming more and more valuable almost daily as they get deeper and deeper in what we do. But NIOSH merely provides a report, right, Gordon?
Yeah, the product that they produce is information. So that information goes into the public domain, it goes to standards-making bodies, it goes to rulemaking bodies, but in itself they're just publishing a report that lays out the information.
We're talking to retired Chief Aaron Feldman and retired Chief Gordon Routley. Aaron from Vancouver and Gordon from both the United States and Canada. We'll be right back. Quite a discussion.
Is it sometimes a little hard to see through the smoke? Do fire service, rescue, and EMS issues work you up just a bit? Maybe more than just a bit? If they don't, check your pulse. It's normal for firefighters and responders to get worked up over hot issues when you love the job so much. Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, Firehouse.com commentator and Firehouse Magazine columnist, hosts Through the Smoke, an internet broadcast and podcast that addresses issues impacting all firefighters, such as safety, health, and morale. Don't ignore the issues and maintain the status quo. Take an interest in issues that impact you, the frontline responder. Join Billy, special guests, and firefighters around the country and the world regularly on Through the Smoke. Only on Firehouse.com.
You're back listening to Through the Smoke, radio at Firehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder, the host. And we're having what I would describe as a pretty sobering discussion on what happens in Canada when a worker, but obviously for the purpose of our discussion, a firefighter is seriously injured or killed. And I guess the biggest question I had, and you answered that, is that they do take a look and assess it. They don't just run around charging people. I mean, as I said, and I've always believed that there are real heroes amongst us, but those who die each year, certainly in our own family as firefighters, we know we're all heroic people. We've all done heroic things. But getting run over, getting ejected, going in without a mask and not under, and then dying in the line of duty, going in with a uncharged hose line, on the fire floor, things like that, we know those things can be avoided, as opposed to those who've gone before us truly heroically and risked their lives to save lives and tragically lost their lives in the process. Let me ask you a question, Gordon. I'm going to. I have other questions for you as well, both you and Aaron. But a quick question to both of you, and then I'm going to yield to Gordon for a minute. These people that come visit the fire department, you've had a bad thing happen. You've had a line of duty death. You've had a serious injury. The investigators from workers' comp, from the federal agencies, are any of them firefighters? Have any of them ever been to a fire?
Not very many. I think in most cases they're general occupational safety and health inspectors. But you know, there may be some that have some particular expertise in it. In most of the provinces, there's some kind of an advisory board that's made up of fire people who provide advice on what should apply to fire departments.
Okay, and, so there is an environment of firefighting that exists.
And in some cases, they'll go out and consult with fire experts on a particular case if they feel they really need it.
Is the system, and I'll ask Aaron this question, I'll ask both of you because I need more than one opinion. Is this system, is this rule, these laws, these federal laws, considered fair and the right thing by your typical Canadian firefighter, whatever that might be, Aaron?
You know, I'd like to think that it is, and I'll just throw an opinion out here. You know, we take this job as an officer, we get promoted, we study for it, we write the tests, and become an officer, and I think it's our duties to take that job seriously, to supervise appropriately, and to lead. And is this law saying anything other than that?
Yeah, right. I mean, we don't, you know, you push all the dust away and all the lights and all the excitement, and we don't want anybody to die. I mean,
no.
Anyone amongst us who wants someone to die should not be amongst us. I mean, you know, and again, we all understand there are those rare occasions where we have to risk our lives, but so often we risk our lives for no reason. Gordon, how about an answer to that question I just asked as well? Would you consider that the unions, the volunteers, the chiefs, et cetera, in Canada, I know you guys don't speak for the Canadian Fire Service, but as a sampling, do they generally, I mean, when they push these laws, were there protests, were there firefighters threatening to quit, saying you're putting us out of business? Did any of that happen up there?
No, I think far from it. I think that the attitude of regulating worker health and safety in all professions has been ingrained for so long that it's just accepted. So, you know, that's a big difference I see. I spent a lot of time working with fire departments in the U.S. and in Canada, and Canadian fire departments are just used to working in this environment where there are very strict health and safety rules, and everybody is expected to follow them. So you don't hear people complaining about it's not fair because it's just part of the system.
Sort of like if you're up on the highway and the speed limit's 65, you can whine and bitch all you want, but the speed limit's still 65.
Yeah.
Just the way it is, and you got to accept that.
Yeah, and the speed limit's been there for as long as anybody can remember. So,
right. So they understand that these are the way we do business. Again, I promised to go to each of you for some points that you guys want to make, but the more we talk, the more questions I have. I got one more. Let's take a scenario. You know, I've been very vocal about you can have a great fire chief with the best training provided, the best everything, the best equipment, the best support, the best understanding, the best policies and procedures. But if that lieutenant or captain in the front seat doesn't care to carry that out, none of it means anything because really, in my opinion, nothing happens if the lieutenant or captain don't make it happen. The other side of the coin is you could have a horrendous fire chief, but if you've got decent lieutenants and captains, they generally can provide a pretty good environment as far as regular training and supervision, things like that. What happens up there? I mean, what would the scenario be? Let's say I'm a fire lieutenant in Canada, and I'm like really into the stuff we're talking about today, but our chief could give a damn. What do I do? How do I deal with that? You know, because you're going to criminally charge me? Well, hell, I'm trying to do my job. But Chief X is not backing me on the mandatory mask rule, is not backing me on the safety rules as far as operating apparatus carefully, is not backing me on company training. What about that? Is that, you ever heard any of that go on, or does everybody kind of buy into this stuff up there?
Well, I think there's one really interesting difference in the law here, which is the right to refuse dangerous work, which is a fundamental right of all employees. And if, you know, for instance, you put yourself into the position of a company officer, if you feel that your department hierarchy isn't doing the things that it should do to support health and safety, then you can basically say, I refuse to work under these conditions, and call in the Occupational Safety and Health Authority for that province to come in and assess the situation. And if they uphold your complaint, they can issue an order to the fire department to change the way the fire department does business.
Does it happen a lot up there?
It doesn't happen a lot, but it happens often enough that it's really interesting. We had a case here, took about 4 years to get through all the appeal process, but it just finished, and it had to do with minimum staffing in a fire station. This was a department that normally staffed a fire station with five people and two pieces of apparatus, three on a Quint and two on a Mini. And on their policy was that they would take one vehicle or the other and send them for training or other special activities.
Okay.
And on a particular day, they took the Mini with two people out of a fire station and left the Quint with an officer and two firefighters. The officer called his chief and said, you know, I consider it dangerous that you're leaving me with three people here because I can't comply with two in and two out. And you're putting me in a potentially dangerous situation. Interestingly, his immediate supervisor agreed and said, yeah, you're right. So he shut down the Mini in a neighboring station, divided the people up so they had four in each station. His supervisor heard about it and said, well, we're just going to see who runs this fire department, and ordered them to take the people back and leave the company with three. So the company officer said, we're out of service. They called in the health and safety inspector who upheld it, and then they got into a legal battle that went on for about 4 years, but was finally upheld that the regulatory authority issued orders to the fire department that they may not staff a fire station at any time with fewer than four people.
Oh, boy. So, I mean... What about false alarms? Let's say I just don't happen to like this officer working today, so I drop the dime. I mean, does that sort of get sorted out, or
that gets sorted out because it wouldn't, you know, it probably wouldn't be upheld on the first pass. The inspector would come and look at it and say that
you're full of crap.
Yeah,
move on. Do your job, soldier.
Yeah, okay. And there's no penalty for, you know, the first time. You know, you can call and say it. You know, I want somebody to look at this, and somebody can come in and look at it and say, no, you're wrong, and, you know, there's no penalty for the first false alarm.
Okay.
If it goes on from that, it gets to be, you know.
They see right through it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Cool. Aaron, some comments on that?
Gordon's observations are very accurate in what I've experienced, and also on a similar topic. There was recently some work I was doing with the department who was having some issues with ICS and safety officers and so on, and they were just ready to shut her down and take it all the way to the top. And the board, this is in British Columbia, and the board is saying, no, you should not do that because what we come down with will be the final say. So why don't you get together with some people and we'll provide you with someone who can come and sit with your people. And that's what they did. They put their safety committee together. They got management at the table. And they had a representative from the board come for informal discussions and sorted it all out. So the board's very civilized in saying, hey, look, we will provide you with a resource so we can sit down at the table and we can say, you know what? You don't have a proper safety officer system in place. You better get it handled. If it goes to my boss, we'll handle it for you.
Okay.
So there's that process in place.
There's a little checks and balances that
exist
there. Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
And it gives a resource to the department to say, you know what? We're stuck here. What do we have to do? Well, we'll get you someone who can help you with it.
Okay. I'll tell you, this has been quite an interesting discussion. This umbrella, I just wonder if tomorrow all fire officers in the United States opened up USA Today or whatever newspaper or TV show they watch, and in USA Today or on TV, Katie Couric or somebody announced, effective today, the law in Canada applies here. I'm pretty sure we do business a little bit differently than we do. Gordon, some final remarks or comments and things you'd like to bring up. And just for you listeners, we're going to make this a multi-part show. It may not be the next one, but we're going to be watching to see what happens in the weeks and months ahead regarding this specific fire so we can learn from it. Clearly, you know, our hearts go out to everyone involved in what's happening up in Northwest Territories, Yellowknife. But we've got to learn from this. And, you know, maybe in the United States it's not a federal law, but, man, the wrong attorney knocking at your door can make it just as bad. Gordon, some comments.
Yeah, I think you're right on the mark about the difference it would make in fire departments in the U.S. You know, having been a safety officer in a major department in the U.S., the biggest problem I had to face was there really were no consequences to the people who didn't want to follow the rules. You know, you could go in and preach safety and try to convince people that they ought to do things the safe way, but it was pretty hard to enforce the rules. Versus coming down and saying, you know, if something happens, you could be criminally charged for failure to enforce the rules, changes the complexion of the discussion pretty quickly.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Aaron, some comments?
You know, I mentioned earlier about we should be taking our job seriously as fire officers, and we should be doing our job, and we should be supervising and leading accordingly, and we've taken the training and wrote the test and all of that. It's not that easy. There's one. The closing comment I want to share with you relative to that is, I believe in speaking with many fire officers of today and yesterday who are saying, you know, it is a really tough job going from a firefighter to a fire officer. You can get promoted on a Monday and be driving in that right front seat promoted on a Friday and in that right front seat on a Monday, and it's a heck of a jump. And we give you some skills and management skills, supervisory skills, and all of that. But you were sitting next to them, you know, at the dinner table and playing volleyball in the backyard or whatever, and you know where I'm going with this. I don't think there's enough emphasis in our training, mentoring, call it what you want, to give that officer that transition assistance to go from, I think someone coined this phrase, going from buddy to boss, and it can happen overnight.
Well, that's Chase Sargent's program. Chase Sargent, retired battalion chief,
yeah,
down
exactly.
In Virginia.
And,
absolutely, and he hits a nail on the head with that.
Yeah,
that's
there's
right.
A lot more work that needs to be there so that when you get into that seat, you know, shoot, I was just, you know, sitting next to this guy having a beer the other day, and now I'm his boss, and, yeah, I'm a little uncomfortable. Well, let's get some resources to help these guys with that, and I think that would really go a long way to you know what, this rig ain't leaving unless you guys are all buckled up.
Sure.
And as a leader, you provide that statement, they're going to see your leadership, and they're going to go, you know, you're right, Cat, we ain't going anywhere till we're all buckled in. Rock
well,
and roll.
Two comments back to that, because that's one of my favorite subjects. Number one, the training of people once they become officers or prior to becoming officers is good, and it's important, and that's actually going to be part two of my comment. But the first step before you become an officer is to talk to yourself, by yourself, and really look deep inside and ask whether you got the courage to enforce the rules and regulations. Not everybody can. It took me a long time in my career to realize these aren't my friends and pals. You know, I'd rather, you know, we were at the IFC Leadership Summit a couple months ago, and Gary Brees had a great comment from a general who was always pissing off his people. And they questioned the general, do you understand most of your people don't like you and they're really pissed off at you because you're always enforcing the rules? And the general responded back saying, that's good, they're alive to stay pissed off at me. And a wonderful quote, and it makes a lot of sense. But it's difficult. You got to live with these people. In some fire departments, it's your brother, your sister, your wife, or husband you're supervising.
Yep.
And it's got to be a real dig deep inside, a real heartfelt decision that, look, I can do this. I can enforce these policies. You don't have to be a jerk about it either. And to firefighters, don't be jerks to the officers. If the rule says slow down, slow the hell down. If the rules say wear your gear, wear your gear. I mean, you know, it's kind of a check and balance thing. And you know, part two to this, and we're going to take a break and let you guys come back with some final remarks before we wrap up, because I know there's a lot on your minds and we're limited on time. Somebody recently asked me, what should we do at the National Fire Academy? And I said, we should get rid of every course they have there. Erase everything. You know, just run a magnet over every file and just shut it down and open it back up again with one course. A 5 to 6 week company officer course that by law everyone in the United States who's going to be an officer after a certain date must take. I don't care if you're in the volunteer fire department, career fire department, combination fire department, paid fire department, well paid, poor paid, doesn't matter. You would have to have this course, and it could be delivered there, it could be delivered anywhere else, you could deliver it over time before you even can take a test. Most of the problems we talk about amongst ourselves here on this show, at your firehouse, at the conventions, all falls down to the abilities or inabilities of the company officer. Not always, but most of it. And I think a good, strong first-line supervisory course would solve a whole lot of problems. We'll be right back with a final wrap-up. You're listening to Through the Smoke, radio at firehouse.com. We're talking Aaron Feldman and Gordon Routley, and I'm Billy Goldfeder. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
You're back listening to Through the Smoke, radio at firehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder, the host. We've been talking about the laws in Canada and how it applies to all workers, but obviously all we're interested in is firefighters, and that's how it's supposed to be. And, wow, there's some pretty significant differences. I don't think there's any difference in the dedication and how we love being firefighters between the United States and Canada, and we truly consider each other brothers and sisters between the two countries. And you know, whether it be as Americans or Canadians, we understand what the other one's going through. But the laws are different up there. It's not a whole lot of choice in how you're going to conduct yourself. And if things don't go right, bam, the hammer comes down, and it's pretty ugly. But it's nothing as compared to what happens when you lose firefighters. And that's what we got to keep in perspective. Is, oh, man, they're going to bust the chief's chops here, or they're going to charge him with this or that. Well, somebody died. It's somebody's husband, somebody's wife, you know, whatever the case may be. And we can never lose perspective and lose touch with that. That's pretty important. And again, what we were talking about before, whether it be here in the United States, I don't know about Canada, but I can tell you, if I had one wish and could click my heels, it would be a federal course, 4 to 6 weeks, that would teach you how to be a first-line company officer if you have the aptitude to do it. Two parts there. So we're going to wrap up. We are going to follow this. We're going to have a part two of this show in the coming weeks based upon what happens with this specific case and follow it, because it's important for us to follow. We have to learn. We don't wish any ill on any of the people going through up there, but there's a whole lot for all of us to learn to see if we can maybe do business a little bit differently here down in the United States. So final comments, Chief Aaron Feldman. Aaron, thanks for your time today. Retired from Vancouver Fire Department as a division chief, active in the Canadian Fallen Firefighters Foundation, active at FDIC here down in the States, and a good friend to us in the American Fire Service. Aaron, some final comments.
First of all, Billy, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been a good time on a very serious topic. And let me add that to enforce what you said, we truly are brothers and sisters across the border. It's been a wonderful enlightenment for me and a pleasure to be working with so many American brothers and sisters over the past couple of years since my retirement. And truly in support of what you're saying about a first-line federal, call it what you want, national-wide supervisory course for those who choose to pursue that, God bless you and make it happen. And something else you said earlier, too, look at yourself. You know, it's okay to retire a firefighter. You know, we're not all cut out to lead men and women in battle. It's peer pressure, a whole host of other things make it very difficult for you to look within yourself and admit that to yourself. But if that's what it tells you, then you know, go with your gut. We've had a few retirees from Vancouver over the years who chose to not get in that right front seat and retired as firefighters and had long, healthy, stress-free careers and loved every day. And by the same token, we've had officers who have gone and shined and moved on and become chiefs and the rest of it. So it's just what I have to say, and it's been a pleasure to be here, and thanks again, Billy.
It ain't easy, and it's not for everybody. And, you know, supervising people, you know, for those of you that are wondering whether you want to promote up or not, or maybe you are and you're not comfortable, it's not for everybody. We need people on the line and operating the equipment and on the hose lines and working the trucks and things like that. It's tough. And there's not a fire officer out there that won't tell you. It's a whole lot different when you get promoted. Gordon Routley, formerly chief of Shreveport, Louisiana, assistant to the fire chief. How long were you in Phoenix, Gordon? Like 75, 80 years or something?
It was only 16 years.
Okay. Well, it sure seemed like a long time when you talked to Bruno. But we appreciate you being here, too. Gordon, some final comments. You're also, of course, very active with the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation here in the United States, and you're the liaison to the IAFC Safety, Health, and Survival section between the Fallen Firefighters Foundation as well. So you got your feet firmly planted on the border, working both sides and focused on firefighter safety and survival. Some final comments.
You know, I think we are all in the fire business because we love the fire service, and you know, we love the camaraderie. And we all need to focus on taking care of each other. We have to focus on the responsibility that we have to, you know, to make sure that everyone goes home safely. It's a wonderful brotherhood or sisterhood that we're involved in, but the consequences when something goes wrong are really devastating. And we just can't afford to wait until we lose a firefighter to deal with the consequences. We have to take the action up front. We have to learn how to prevent firefighter fatalities. We have to, you know, adopt the policies. We have to enforce the policies. We have to do everything we possibly can to prevent the worst imaginable things from happening to us. And you know, that's the way we need to live our lives.
Appreciate that. You know, it doesn't take the fun and enjoyment and the feeling of being firefighter away. You know, if you talk to some of these folks who've been involved in line of duty deaths, talk to a fire chief, talk to Mark Wessel, fire chief of Keokuk, Iowa, Jeff Meston from Novato, California, or Billy Glassman, fire chief in Gloucester City, New Jersey. I mention them because we're doing a 16-hour class at the FDIC in a few weeks, Monday and Tuesday, where they're going to share in depth the case studies of their fires. You know, talk to people who've been through this, and they'll tell you got no choice but to operate differently. It's all fun and games until something tragically goes wrong. So again, thanks to Aaron Feldman and Gordon Routley for your time today. We will be revisiting this with you guys in the near future. And to our listeners, take this stuff to heart. Pay attention. Spend some time training. Next time you're sitting around bitching whether the recliners are comfortable or not, get up off your asses and spend a couple hours pulling hose lines, climbing a ladder, advancing a line, doing some search and rescue, the basic stuff. There's loads of drills on firehouse.com you can download. Our website, firefighterclosecalls.com, has weekly fire drills. Almost all this stuff comes down to training. And even more importantly, this week, take some time to remember the families, the friends, the fellow firefighters and fire officers of Phoenix Fire Department's Brett Tarver, Pittsburgh Bureau of Fires Battalion Chief Charles Brace and Richard Stephanakis, Chesapeake, Virginia's Frank Young and John Hudgens, and Yellowknife, Canada Fire Lieutenant Cyril Fife and Firefighter Kevin Olson. Take some time. If you look on the webpage right here where you click to listen to the show, we've got some downloads there. You can read the fire reports. We're going to post the fire reports on there for you on some of these fires so you can learn what happened so it doesn't happen again. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again soon. This is Through the Smoke, radio at firehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder. Goodbye.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.